Okay, so today I'm going to talk a little bit about user interface toolkits and more generally the tools that we use to create user interfaces, graphical user interfaces. So we'll look first at the notion of software layers, and then we'll go through the layers with graphical libraries, Windows systems, user interface toolkits, application frameworks, and interface builders. And I'll give a short demo at the end of an interface builder. So the way interactive applications are created today is you have an operating system, so it can be Windows or Linux or Mac OS X or iOS or Android, one of these. And part of the operating system includes device drivers that control the display, the input devices like the mouse or the touch screen, and things like this. Now you could build your application like this. This is what we were doing 25 years ago. But over the years, people have created various layers to help with the process. So the first layer, both in the stack and historically, has been a graphical library. When you have a screen, you display on the screen by turning pixels on and off, which is pretty basic. So graphical library gives you an abstraction over the drawing surface, and we'll see various types of, two main types of graphic libraries to make it easier to draw on the screen. Now recently, as you know, computers come with not only a CPU for computing, but also a GPU, a graphics processing unit. And so these days, a graphical library is really a front end to the GPU, which does most of the work. And the important function of the graphical library is to give the same API programming interface, whichever graphics card you have, GPU or graphic device. So that's the first layer. Come in. Then the second layer is typically the Windows system. As we started creating interfaces on graphical devices, the notion of Windows came around in the early 80s. And the idea is that for an application, the access to the display device is through a window. So originally, windows were seen as virtual terminals. The application would see the window as if it were the full screen. And so the window system is really close to the operating system so that multiple applications can share the space of the display through the window system. And then once you have window system graphical library, it's still very hard to create applications because every time you want to create a button, for example, you have to write all the code to draw the button, to respond to user actions on the button. And so that also started in the 80s. People started creating what is called now user interface toolkits. Now you've used one called Swing on Java, and there are many others. And they give you a number of abstractions to create interfaces more like a game of Lego, where you take existing bricks, like a button, a menu, a scroll bar, and plug them together, and you create your application. And the latest, the topmost level in this stack is what is called the framework, which adds to the user interface toolkits a number of functions that usually are not in the toolkit. Things like managing the history of actions, and undo and redo. Things like managing the notion of a link between a document on disk and the document in the window. And other general functions that are not really usually in the toolkit. In many cases, these two things tend to be merged into the same layer, but they do address different problems. And finally, it's not on this diagram, but to help create these interfaces, people have started creating interface builders. That is a tool where you create the interface visually. Instead of writing the code that creates a button and a menu and a scroll bar, you have a visual tool and you can drag and drop, you know, a button from the palette and put it in your interface. You can describe the layout.
And it generates the code behind.
And depending on how it works, it can generate code or it can do it in different ways. We'll look at it at the end. And I'll show a quick demo of the system on the Mac OS. It's called Interface Builder. So we'll get back to this. So what I'm going to do now is to go from more or less bottom of the stack to the top to see a little bit what's inside each of these layers. Okay, that is if the system works. What's happening? Okay, here we are. So, first, very quickly about the lowest level, the devices, the output devices and input devices. Output devices, we use screens mostly, and I will not talk here about audio output, so I will stay with graphical interfaces. So the technology for the screens themselves has evolved a lot over the years. We started with things that were even more primitive than the CRTs that we're used to, and now most of the screens, I would say, are LCD-based, but there are new technologies coming out. Plasma has been around for a while. There's also some laser-based displays that are coming out. The common point of almost all of these displays historically has been to consider the screen as a matrix of pixels. So you have rows of pixels. So each image is made of little dots. This was not always the case. And some early screens were, in fact, created by having a CRT display where the beam of electrons is controlled. And so by controlling the path, you could literally draw a shape with the beam of electrons on the screen. And the problem is that the image would disappear quickly, so you would have to redraw the shape constantly for it to stay on the screen. So touch screens don't exist anymore. And now all the screens are made of this notion of matrix of pixels. Once you have a pixel, you need to have a way to tell which color is each pixel. So again, there are several ways of doing this. Two standard ways is to use a color table. So a pixel is in fact a value coded on 2 bits or 1 bit or 4 bits, so 8 or whatever, and that value is an index in the color table. And so if this is the value 105, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, this is color red. And if I change the entry of this table here, if I put blue here, all the pixels that were red become blue. And in the old days, there was a lot of trickery to use this to create some kind of animation quickly, because it was not possible to do the animation in real time on the screen. So using the table here, you could do some kind of animation. Nowadays, most displays have what's called direct color. That is, the value of the pixel here directly codes the RGB value of the color. Now, the thing to keep in mind is managing the screen has been a major bottleneck in terms of computing power. So if you have a screen 1,000 by 1,000 pixels to run things up, if each pixel has 3 bytes, one for R, G, and B, and if you want to display a full screen animation, like, say, video, 25 images per second, you need 75 megabits per second of constant output from the CPU. Now, this sounds like not much today, but just 10 years ago, this was something that most computers couldn't do. Right? And the biggest increase in the power of computers has not been in the CPU. I mean, Moore's law has been really improving that, but graphical processing has increased a lot faster than CPU. And in fact, as I was saying, most displays today, most computers include a graphics processing unit that is even oftentimes more powerful than the CPU itself. In fact, you start seeing people who are using GPUs to do high-performance computing. One of the fastest machines in the world today are done with racks of GPUs rather than CPUs. And why did that happen? Well, it's not because of graphical user interfaces. The main driver, so do you know why we have GPUs and graphics processing is so fast today? Okay, what is the other big consumer of graphics processing?
Video games.
Video games, yes, exactly. It is really the industry of video games that has pushed Intel's and others to create these specialized graphics units. Now, the good thing for you and us today is that essentially this is not a problem anymore. In the good old times, you couldn't move a window with all its content by clicking and dragging. The thing would you know, redisplay once a second or something. So you would do an outline of the window and it made interaction really poor. Now all these things are pretty much solved, at least when you are looking at a reasonable size screen and a new computer. Now on the side of input devices, things have not changed as much. The mouse, the tablet, the joystick, the trackball, and the touchscreens have been here for as long as anybody can remember. Do you remember when the mouse was invented? So that in the first class.
'82.
74. Well, you're still off by a decade. It was 63. 1963, Doug Engelbart. 82 is when the Xerox Star came out, 81. And that was the first commercial computer with a mouse. But the invention itself was 20 years before. And that's something to keep in mind, is most of the things that are presented, you know, today as something new are 20, 30 years old. Everybody is talking about touch screens, like on the iPhone or iPad or tablets in general. These touch surfaces, touch-sensitive surfaces, have been around since the 70s. So it is important to distinguish between the invention, when the thing was created first, the mouse was invented in 63, and then there is the innovation, is when an invention is brought to market. And that takes 20 years, 30 years, and it's not much faster with computer technology. The web, you know, came out in about 94, but you find hypertext system 25 years before that. So in terms of input devices, it's the same story. All of these things have been around for a long, long time. And the ones we see today are technical refinements of these devices, but not fundamentally different. So what distinguishes those devices are several key properties. One is the type of user control. So if I have a mouse, I am moving the mouse. And it's the mouse motion that is translated into cursor motion. If I have a joystick, some joystick, I move the joystick. But in some, it's more force resistant. So it's force that is translated into motion of the cursor. In some cases, I move things linearly or in circular ways. So a joystick, in fact, the ones that move, they move around the point. So it's, in fact, circular movement. And another aspect that makes a difference is whether it's absolute versus relative. So if I have a mouse, I can move the mouse, lift the mouse, went back here and start over again. So what is translated is not the absolute position of the mouse in the space, it's only its relative motion. And when you have relative motion like this, you have the sometimes the need of clutching, that is lifting the mouse, coming back and restarting. And so it's both a good thing and a bad thing. With clutching, it means you can go a long distance with the cursor, even though you have a small distance on the trackpad. But the clutching takes time. A touchscreen, for example, or a tablet, tends to be absolute. If I touch on the screen, it's that position. If I put the pen on the tablet, it's that position in the tablet space that is directly mapped to the cursor. So you can have the cursor jump from one position to the next. So all of these things are key differences when it comes to the usability of these devices for a particular task. And there has been many studies comparing the mouse with the tablet, with the joystick, with other types of devices, to see which one was the most effective. And it's a very complex thing because there are so many parameters you can play with. For example, you're probably all familiar with the notion of mouse acceleration, right? On your computer you have a setting to make the mouse faster. Well, it doesn't really make the mouse faster literally. What it controls is this curve that is how much the cursor moves for some incremental move of the mouse. So this is, on this axis, it's delta mouse. So if I move the mouse slowly, I will be around here in the graph, to the left. If I move the mouse fast, I'm here. So if I have a linear curve like this, it means that the cursor responds linearly. But if I have a curve like this one, then it means that if I'm to the left, I'm moving slowly, have very slow response for the cursor, which means I have a precise cursor. And if I'm to the right, I have a much faster cursor moving. So the acceleration of the mouse is in fact the shape of this curve. Little acceleration is something linear. And the more acceleration, the more curved it is. And it's done in a way that, in fact, most people don't notice exactly how it works or don't notice that it's there at all. So it's an interesting thing that our body sort of adapts to this distortion of space, the fact that what I'm moving on the mouse pad has a different effect on the screen. This is what I call the motor space versus visual space here. I move things at a certain speed and it moves faster or slower on the screen. The body internalizes this mapping and adapts to it very quickly. The graph in the middle here, which is this broken line, is what used to be the response curve, the transfer function, for the cursor on old version of X Windows on Linux. And so all they had was a threshold and two linear gains, one below and one above this threshold. And that is terrible, because it means if you're moving a mouse around this limit here, your cursor is going to be jerky. So this was very simple to implement, of course, but very poor. Now, the curves are actually not like this. They tend to taper at the top, because you don't want the cursor to go too fast either. So, for the computer, you know, whether you're using a mouse, a tablet, a joystick, a trackball, a touchscreen, whether you have acceleration or not, all what it will receive is 2D positions, X and Y, and all your computer will, your program will deal with is the position of the cursor. But it's important to realize that if you change these things, it will dramatically affect the usability of your system. So some system, and in fact, the reason the mouse has been around for so long and is still there is that it has been shown to not be the best at any task, but to be overall pretty good. So it's because it's that flexible that it works well pretty much for tasks that require precision or tasks that require being fast, that is still there, while others like the joystick, for example, are good for precision but not good for going fast, for example. Now, of course, these are 2D input devices which are critical in the graphical user interface. There are many other input devices, the keyboard, of course, but the keyboard has not changed really in many, many years. And other devices are really reserved for specific applications, like button boxes or sliders. If you are doing music mixing, for example, you may want to use sliders, like a mixing console. If you are dealing with 3D objects, you may want to use 3D position and orientation sensors. Did you all see the demo that we did of the Wild Room at LRI? The large wall display and all that? Yes. So you saw that we have this tracking system called the Vicon that can locate something in the whole space. So this is an example of a 3D sensor. So there are many, many other input devices. From the computer, they almost always end up being something that sends a vector of coordinates in some space. Even the keyboard can be seen as something that sends you the matrix representing, you know, which key is down, which key is up at some point. Okay, so I'm going to skip the graphical library slide to get to managing input here, and I'll get back to it in a second. So all these input devices, they are tracked through device drivers by the operating system, as you saw in the first drawing. Now the question is, how is the program going to deal with this? In traditional programs, you don't really deal with input devices that send input all the time or whenever they want. In traditional programming, you have a program that says, give me input when it needs input, then processes it, spits the result, and then says, you know, stop or give me more input. So having interaction, programming interaction, has always been sort of not natural in programming model of standard languages. So originally, the way to program was to do exactly the same thing as when you have a program that waits for some text to be typed, the input, with a query mode. You say, okay, mouse, give me your position. And essentially, this would be a blocking call until the mouse state would change, either by moving or clicking the button. Of course, if you do this, you cannot multiplex a mouse and the keyboard. You have to wait for the mouse or wait for the keyboard, but not the two at once. So it doesn't work for multiple devices. So the other approach is to do what's called busy waiting, where you ask a device, tell me your state now, immediately. You get that state, and then you can continue. And if you have multiple devices, you're going to do polling, which is looking at each device in turn. Now, this allows you to manage multiple devices, but you get busy waiting, which means your computer spends its time querying for devices that most of the time do nothing. At the speed of the computer, you know, this is a lot of wasted resources. So this is not a good solution either. So the solution that is now universally applied is that of an event queue. Your device driver does whatever it wants, but when it detects that the state of a device has changed, it adds an event in a waiting list. So it says the mouse has moved, the cursor has been pressed, the keyboard has been pressed, and you can even have events like a new device has been added or removed if you plug or unplug a new device and things like this. And then the application here can, whenever it feels ready, pull an event out of the queue process it, and get to the next event. So that is a nice model because it generalizes to arbitrary devices. The goal, of course, is to have the queue empty all the time. Every time events accumulate here, it means that the user has done something with the device that has not yet been handled by the application, which will be perceived as a lag, something, slow response. So the goal is to try to have this empty most of the time, but if it isn't, nothing is lost. And so the resulting programming style is that your application is going to be a loop, getting the next event, processing that event as fast as possible, and then looking for the next one. And when you program with Swing, which you did in the TD, or with any other toolkit, that's what you're doing. You don't necessarily see the event loop itself, but the fact that you use listeners or handlers or these types of callbacks is because your toolkit is doing this event queue processing and then deciding what to call in response to the input event. So that's what we call event-driven programming. And essentially, all interactive programs run an infinite loop, saying, while running, wait until there's an event in the queue. If when I'm done here, so I avoid doing a busy loop. I stop while there's nothing to do. When there's something to do, I extract the event. I figure out which object in my interface is going to handle that event. So it can be based on the position in that event or some other state. And if I find a target for the event, then I hand off the event to the target. The target processes it. It should do it as fast as possible. And then I go back to the loop. And so you have programming styles where this event loop is running here, and pieces of code that you write are being called sort of randomly or in response to these events. That makes programming, in fact, very difficult and brittle and hard to change, because generally these pieces of code here need to interact with each other, to communicate with each other, and so we start sharing global variables or doing all the things that traditional programming has told you not to do. So we'll get back to this in a little bit. So this is how input events are handled. So let me get back now to the notion of graphical libraries. So to control the display of the screen, there are two categories of models. One is called direct drawing, and the other one is called structured drawing. So what direct drawing is, the abstraction is you have a painting surface, it's often called a canvas, and the functions that the graphical library give you allow you to paint on this canvas. So you can say draw a line, or paint a rectangle, or display that JPEG image. There is absolutely no memory in the system of what has been painted before. You paint on the canvas, and if you want to change something, you have to repaint the whole canvas. So this seems very inefficient, but it takes full advantage of the thing you have in the GPUs in particular. It's called the painter's algorithm because everything you paint is on top of what is already there. So if I have this drawing here with these three rectangles, and now I want to move this rectangle, the one at the top here, the blue one, well, I cannot just redraw it to its new position because that will be painted on top of everything else, and the old one is still there, and the new one will be above the pink one in particular. So if I want to move this, I have to either erase everything and paint at the new position and then the other things in the right order, or I can be a bit more clever, I can figure out that, you know, this part at the bottom is not changing, so I'm going to repaint only a subset here to make it to have the right result. So with direct drawing, it's very silly, and it can be very fast, but it means that the application has to do more work to maintain a proper state. Structured drawing, on the other hand, uses what is called a scene graph. That is, the application is not really dealing with the drawing surface itself. It's dealing with a data structure called the scene graph that says, well, there is a rectangle, and there is another rectangle here, and with some rules saying, for example, the objects are displayed in the order of the list. And so I can then manipulate this structure. I can exchange the order of two objects, for example, or I can change their attributes. And then the graphic library will do what it takes to update the drawing. So structured drawing is a lot easier on the application and takes more work from the graphic library. So if you look at the systems that are used today, in fact, a lot of them are based on direct drawing. And the reason is that even though structured drawing is better in principle, if you use structured drawing, you would in fact have a copy of this structure in what we'll see later on, the user interface toolkit. So a toolkit will manage things like buttons and sliders and menus, and these are objects. And so they also define the equivalent of a scene graph. So the better trade-off that has been found in most toolkits today was to use a painting model that is direct drawing. So in Java, it's Java 2D, for example. In other tools, it's a different one. On macOS, it's called Quartz. On Linux, there are several of them. One of them is Cairo, for example. All of these are direct drawings because the structured part and the notion of having an abstract data structure describing the content of the screen is done at a higher level in the application. But there are things that use structured drawing. For example, if you know SVG in a web browser, so SVG is a structured drawing model. And scene graphs originally were created mostly for 3D graphics. Open scene graph is one. Originally, Inventor, I think, created that. And the reason is because in a 3D scene...
you need to manage the component at each time.
Right. And in a 3D scene, if you change one thing, oftentimes the whole display, the whole image will change. So if you have a camera and you move the camera a little bit, everything changes. If you move a light, all the lighting changes. So in 3D graphics, oftentimes you do a little change and you have to repaint everything. And so optimizing that takes a lot of work, and it's better done at a lower level of abstraction. In 2D graphics, the situation is different. Now, these things, in fact, are starting to converge. And I think eventually, because of the power of the GPUs, you will not have so much differences in the future. So, so I didn't have time to get into the details here, but as you can imagine, graphical objects are defined by geometry. Is it a rectangle or a circle, and what is the coordinates? And their graphical attributes, the color, the texture, like we have here, the gradient, so it's a color that changes from one value to another, sometimes the transparency, Sometimes you can have lighting, even in 2D, which creates those gradients. You can have shadows like we have here. And these graphical models have become in 2D graphics a lot more detailed, refined than they used to be. These things like lighting or transparency only used to exist for high-end 3D graphics. Now they are really part of 2D graphics because computers can process that in real time. And if you look at the screen of any new operating system, whether it's Windows, Linux, or macOS, they do a lot of transparency, shadow, gradients, and things like this, which they are able to do in real time. But again, just 10 years ago, this was not possible. So things have changed extremely quickly. Okay, so that's graphical libraries. Okay, now we get one level up with the windowing systems. So as I said, the notion of window was designed to organize the display surface and make it possible to have different activities going on simultaneously in different windows. And the idea is that when you write an application, you display to a window. You don't display to the full screen, you display to a window. So the window system is in charge of creating this abstraction where each application thinks it has the whole window for itself, and then the window system is supposed to manage how these windows are organized on the screen. So it's really a resource sharing problem. It's like multiple computers trying to access the same printer. Except for a printer, you have to multiplex things in time, and on the screen you multiplex things in space. But it's essentially the same type of problems. So window is an autonomous area on the screen, both for display but also for input. So the user is going to use the mouse all over the screen, and then the window system will have to decide, okay, who gets that next event. And then there is a user interface to the window system, the ability to move a window, to resize a window, maybe to close it, iconify it, and things like this. And that's what's called the window manager. And these things are very separate. The window manager is really the UI for the window system, but the window system is a separate entity. So originally, the first window systems were doing tiling windows, so the windows would not overlap. It was partition of the screen. Now, this was done because it was easier to program, and again, because computers were not very powerful, it was manageable. It has also a big advantage, is that you're sure to see everything on the screen at once. And in fact, it's interesting that now you see a number of window systems that give you the ability to tile windows, because you realize that overlapping windows are very nice in principle, but they can be complicated to manage for the user. So overlapping windows came out with the work at Xerox that led to the Xerox Star in particular. And the idea here is to have windows overlap like sheets of paper on the desk. So this is the familiar model that you know. And in the X window system, I don't know if it was the first one, but certainly one was the one that popularized the notion of hierarchical windows. So window here, the green window, contains the blue one and the reddish one here. And then the red contains a light blue one. And because the light blue one is inside the red or yellow one here, part of it is hidden. So the rule here is that you only see a window inside its parent. And then within the parent, I didn't show it here, but there is an overlapping relationship. So the blue one would probably be in front of these two. So, and at the root of the system, you have something that represents the whole screen. So this is the model that is used in the X window system. And in fact, when we speak of windows, we often think of the top level windows, the one that hold a document or the dialog box, the one we can manipulate as windows. But if you look at an application in the X window system, it's using windows at all the levels, down to an individual button, for example, is going to be implemented with a window. In the next window, the system was designed so creating a window, managing a window, was very cheap. Originally, the idea is that you would have, you know, 4, 5, maybe 10 windows on the screen, and so a window was something heavy and an expensive resource. With X Windows, and that was back in the mid-80s, maybe late-80s, they were testing their system with thousands of windows, which people thought was really silly. But the idea is that you could use windows not just at the top level for application windows, but also to organize the content of a window down to a button was a very clever idea, because it means that a lot of work could be done by the window system. If you want to know where you're clicking in your in what part of your window you're clicking, are you clicking in the in the title bar, are you clicking in the button, are you clicking on the scroll bar? If each of these items are windows, then the window system can tell you immediately, because its job is to know where you're clicking. If you're not doing this, it means you have to do a lot, reprogram a lot of the same things that the window system knows to do already. I'll get a bit more details about the X window system. And then there are one more steps, is the notion of rooms or virtual screens or virtual desktops. The idea is that once your screen is too crowded, well, why don't you create another one? And they have another set of windows on a different screen. And the system will show you one of these at once. This was originally called Rooms, and was created in 1986 by Henderson and Card, and it was done at Xerox PARC as well. And the idea with Rooms is that to go from one room to another room, you would have a door. Window, the rooms would contain windows and would have doors. There was also already in the original version the idea that some windows would stay with you as you move from one room to the next. If you have a clock or a little application you want to have everywhere, you could attach it and it would stay with, it would follow you when you change room. And of course, that's a case of something that took close to 20 years to become mainstream. So for example, here on the Mac, I have various windows, I mean various virtual screens, and I even have an overview here that shows me all the 6 rooms I have, and I can go to anyone directly. Okay. Now, managing overlapping windows, again, originally was something that was pretty difficult given the capability of the machine. So here is a simple example where these two windows overlap each other, and in the window in the back, I have this one line that is drawn here. And now the user says, I want this window on top. So what would typically appear happen is that the window system would say, well, okay, I know how to erase the part of the blue window that was on top, but I am not keeping track of what has been drawn in the hidden part. And the reason is because if you had to do that, it would mean a lot of memory spent to keep track of the hidden part of all the windows. And if you have 10, 20 windows, you could have 10 times the surface of your screen in what's called off-screen memory to remember what was in those hidden parts. And at the time, you didn't have this type of memory. You know, today you have computers with 2-4 gigabytes of memory. At the time, it was, if you had 64K, you were you were pretty happy. So the solution to this was to say, well, the application that drew this in the first place, it's going to be its responsibility to redraw it when it becomes exposed. So what happens is the Windows system will just erase the part here, and then it will send an event to that to the application managing that window, telling it, redraw. This thing is now damaged. And then the application would need to maintain enough information to redraw this. And that's how it still works today, especially on X Windows. And it's very efficient. Now, if you look at the more recent Windows systems on the Mac or on Windows, because now memory has become cheap, they do tend to keep the memory off screen. And so I am not sure about Windows, but I know for a fact on Mac OS, when you create a window, in fact, the window is off screen, completely off screen. And then there is a different, well, part of the Windows system is called a compositor that takes the multiple windows and composes them on the screen. And so that's why it's able to do things like what I was showing here, this types of effect where I can even move things around. It's because all these windows exist off screen, and there's a very fast GPU that can do this compositing operations. So that's another example where things have changed a lot. So drawing is one, maintaining the state of the display is one task of the Windows system. Another task is input management. So as we saw, that there's those events coming through an event queue, and the job of the window manager is to decide which application will manage each event. Of course, we don't want all the events to go to all the applications, because that would be a mess. So that, in turn, relies on two main models for managing the notion of active window. In some systems, you have to click a window to make it active, and then almost all input is going to that window. Right? In other systems, you just need to move the cursor over the window, and that window gets the input. So you have the sort of click to focus and automatic focus. And by and large, it's a matter of taste. Some users prefer one style, some prefer the other style. So based on this notion of focus, the window system knows to which window it should send the events. But as we saw, the window system itself is adding its own events to the event stream. So the request, the redraw request that I talked about, telling window you should redraw yourself because part of you is visible that was not before. Also notifying that a new window has been created or deleted, so the window system can communicate with the other windows using additional events. And so this notion of event-based programming now is used not just for input events, but for all sorts of events that come from the environment. So the window system is one, but another one would be network events. You know, there's you have a connection to a server, and there's some data coming. So this comes through the event queue as well, because it means that then this event loop I was mentioning can multiplex input from different sources: the user, the window system, the other computers through the network, and inter-process communication as well. And so that unifies things in a way, which makes programming a little bit easier. Okay? What's going on? So let's look a little bit at the architecture of the X-Window system. The X-Window system was, again, certainly not the first one historically, but the one that popularized the notion of the window system as a separate application called a server. Until then, the most window systems were sort of merged with the operating systems or merged with the graphical library, and so there was no this clear distinction, as I explained before. So with the X-Window system, you have the window system is a server, which for many people was sort of a twist of things. Why is this window system a server, not a client? So it's a server because it sits between the hardware, the screen and the keyboard and the mouse, and the applications that are clients that want to access this hardware. So some clients can run on the same machine, but what was very new with X-Window is that the client could sit on a different machine and talk to that server through a network connection. And for years and years, before we had cheap laptops and things like this, we used to have a powerful machine where we would run the clients, and then on our desk, we would have a very cheap, well, cheap at the time, computer that was running the Windows server and nothing else. And in fact, for a number of years, they were selling what were called X terminals, X window terminals, the computer that would just run the server and have the hardware, and all the clients would be on the distant machine. So the way it works is that clients send requests to the server. Those requests can be create a new window, draw something in that window, tell me when there is an event of that sort in that window, and things like this. And if you know the address, the ID, the number of a window, any client can manage any window. In practice, you only know the ones you've created, but if clients communicate with each other to pass around window numbers, this client could perfectly address that window, which is something that hasn't been used very much, but was a powerful thing. So these requests are then sort of multiplexed by the Windows server that then manages the display. Now, on the return path, the input events go to the server. The server decides which window is involved. And then, depending on which client has asked to be notified when that particular type of event happens on that particular window, the event will be sent to one, sometimes several clients, but in general, one client. And again, the key here is that this can work over the network. And in fact, what makes X-Windows, it's not the server. What makes X-Windows is the protocol that is used for client and server to communicate. And this protocol is very precisely described. There's, you know, all the possible messages that can be exchanged. And it has been optimized to work over the network. In particular, when a client sends a request to, for example, create a new window, nothing happens, which is the fastest way to do things, right? So what happened is the client says, create a window for me. It doesn't even get to the client, to the server here. The library in the client that manages this protocol say, okay, I'll put this packet, this request, in the output buffer, and I'll wait until the output buffer is full to send it all at once. But I noticed that it is a window creation request, and so I'm going to tell back the client, here is your window number. And then the client can start drawing in the window, and the same thing happens, nothing. The packet create, you know, draw something, accumulate in the output buffer here, and nothing happens. And then, finally, the buffer fills up, and the client says, okay, so now I need to send this. So the advantage of this is when you are over a network, especially Ethernet networks, the cost is sending one message. Whether the message is 1 byte or 1,000 bytes, it's the same thing. There's a maximum size. But so the idea is by buffering, you use the network much better. And in fact, you can run the server on the client in what's called a synchronous mode, where packets are sent immediately, and you will find that it goes 10 times more slow because of this. So there are three cases where the output buffer is sent. First case is when it becomes full. The second case is when the request you're sending requires a reply, and you don't have the answer here. So if you're asking for a window number, the client can generate a window number by maintaining a counter, saying, well, this is the next one. But if you're asking for the current position of the mouse, or tell me the state of this other window, you have to go here. So to make sure the state is consistent, whenever you need a response, everything that has been stored is sent as well. And the third time where the output buffer is sent is when the client is waiting for the next event. And so if you remember the event loop, an event arrives, the client reads the event, and in response to this event, it's going to make a number of things, and some of the things will change the display. So it will say, display this, display that, display that. All of this does nothing, and the time just gets stored here. Then processing the event is finished, goes back to the event loop, and the client says, give me the next event. Only at this point does the client send all the requests that have been sent in one batch. And because all of this happens quickly, you don't see it, and you have a fairly efficient system. Okay, I realize I didn't translate this. Okay, any questions about this? Okay, now we get to user interface toolkits. So, the top right here, you've seen my little stack of layers. So, user interface toolkits introduce a new abstraction on top of Windows called widgets. Sorry?
Windows
gadget. Widgets. So widget is both a play on word on the word gadget, but also means a window object or window gadget. So something that is linked to a window somehow. So widget is an interactive object or component, a software component. And examples include buttons, menus, scroll bars, dialog boxes, input text fields and things like this. And each of these objects is characterized by three aspects, or three facets. One is the presentation, how does it look? Second is the behavior, how does it react to user input? And the third is the application interface, how does it communicate with the rest of the application? So when you see this, you know it's a button because of the way it looks. But what really makes it a button is the fact that its behavior is the behavior of a button. So when you click on it, it will probably change color or something to show you're clicking, and then when you're done clicking, it will trigger something. The something it triggers is not part of the button itself, it's through the application interface. If I have this, well, I know it's a slider, and same thing, it has a particular look, it behaves in a particular way, when I click here or here or there, it does different things, and it triggers calls to the rest of the application for scrolling the document, presumably, through the application interface. So creating an interface is then playing Lego, taking all these bricks and assembling them into what we call a widget tree. In this tree, some nodes are containers that contain other nodes, and some nodes are the end of the tree, the leaves. The leaves are the simple widgets, like a button, a scroll bar. The containers are windows, like this dialog box, or a menu that contains a bunch of items. So it's a composition game. And so since you've programmed a bit with Swing, I think you've seen that, how you create this hierarchy. Now, creating the hierarchy is one thing. It tells you which objects you have. Then there is the question of layout. How are they organized on the screen? And the problem with layout in these systems is that many of the windows that contain these widgets can be resized by the user. And so when you resize the window, how do you want the content to reorganize itself? And one way would be to say, well, every time the window is resized, I call the application through a callback, for example, or an event, and say, well, you have to reorganize the content. Another way would be to describe things more declaratively, saying, well, here is the layout, and here is how it's going to change. So the first rule is that a widget is, in general, geometrically enclosed in its parent. I say in general because this is not always the case. The notable exception are menu. If I have a menu bar, this menu is going to be the file menu. So in terms of the hierarchy, this menu is a child of the menu bar. But of course, this menu is not contained in the menu bar, because if it were, I wouldn't see it. So the rule that the widget is inside its parent has a couple of exceptions. The second rule is that each widget knows its natural size. It says, well, I'm the OK button, and so I need to have at least this size to display myself correctly. But the parent really controls all the layout and the sizes of the widgets in them. And so a complex part of any toolkit is the layout algorithm that this, you know, defines how things are organized. And typically it's going to start from the natural size of each of the widget, saying, okay, what size would you like to have? And then given this, and given the constraints of the layout, it will impose a final size and position on all the children. So for example, if you look at a menu, each item will say, well, I need this size, I need this size. What the menu, the parent, will do is say, well, which one is the biggest? And I'll take that as the size of the menu, and then I'll force all the items to have this size. And that's how you have a menu that has the size big enough to see everything, but not bigger. In terms of layout, one of the things we'll see, for example, in Interface Builder in a moment, is the idea of describing the layout with constraints. So instead of saying, you know, the OK button is going to be at X equals 200 and Y equals 35, what you say is each widget is usually a rectangle, and you can constrain the sizes of these rectangles with the position of other rectangles in the drawing. So here I'm saying that, you know, file is at a fixed distance from the left. There's a fixed distance between the file and the text box here. The text box itself is a fixed distance from the top, and the right size of this is a fixed distance. Now, something I'm not showing here, but is it implicit, is that this labeled file is a fixed width, but this one is extensible. And so when I stretch this dialog box, this will stay fixed, this, and this as well. The only thing that will enlarge is this here. At the bottom here, I've put these constraints for the OK and cancel buttons. And so if I enlarge this, what happens? Yes, the two of them will move and will stay at the bottom right. If I had attached it here, they would stay in the center and they would shrink. So this looks very nice and appealing. In practice, when it gets complicated, it's not always easy to predict what you're doing. And sometimes you can have something that is over-constrained and that the system cannot manage. So layout is always complicated, and if you've done any swing programming, this is particularly bad in swing. Okay, so here's what happens when you enlarge this example. So as I said, there are facets to widget. Presentation is the visual appearance. It is sometimes configurable. In the in older version of the X-Window system, you had a resource file where you could change the colors and the font and things of every application. On the Macintosh, it's also a resource file that resources that you can often edit, even if you don't have access to the source code. The behavior is usually not configurable, because what makes a button, as I said, is that it behaves like a button. So the behavior is described as how the widget reacts to user actions. And finally, the application interface is how the widget does notify user actions and state changes to the outside world. So that's the more interesting part of this, because there are several ways of doing this, and they're all complicated in a way. And a lot of the programming you do is playing with this. Is, you know, the hard part is not to say I want a button here and I want a scroll bar there. It's to sort of wire things together so the interface works as expected. So the basic concept for the application interface is what's called a callback function. And the notion of a callback is that you create an object at some point, and you know that when the object changes, you want it to call something, but you don't know yet what it is going to be. So a callback is the address of a function that you register in the object, so that when it needs to call that function, it will have a link to it. And you can change the callback function. In some system, you can have multiple callbacks in Java Swing, they're called listeners. It's a little bit different, but it's the same basic idea. So the first phase is when you create the object, or shortly after, you register the callback. Say, call this when this happens to you. And then that's all you have to do. Later on, when an event like click is sent to the button will say, oh, I've been clicked, so I need to activate my callback. So here's the callback, I call it. And so here's what's happening. Now the problem is that very quickly you get into what's called a spaghetti of callbacks. Here's an extremely simple example. I have a file dialog that asks me which file to save to, and has an OK and a cancel button. So presumably, the text field here has a callback, so that whenever I change the text in there, I will record the name of the file in some variable. And then when I click OK, then I know I need to save to the file that I had typed in there. But you see that these are two different callbacks. They don't know each other. The only way to have them know each other is through a global variable here. And we've all learned that global variables are terrible in programming. And in fact, you can imagine that if you take this approach, you will have thousands and thousands of global variables in an interactive program. Imagine the number of dialog boxes you have in Word or Photoshop or something like this. So this is a very simple mechanism, but it is really problematic, and it makes the code very hard to maintain and to modify. So people have tried to fix this. So one approach that unfortunately is used in very few toolkits is the notion of active values. The idea is that the number of the widgets we use, it's not the case of a button, but a slider, a scroll bar, the text field, they are really input widgets by which the user specifies a value. And the idea here with active values is to establish a link between a particular widget and the variable in my program, so that whenever the user changes the widget, the variable gets updated. And vice versa, when the program changes the variable, then the widget changes, maybe even animates. So instead of having callbacks that will do all the different things here, you establish this link declaratively between the widget and the variable. And once you've done that, that's it. You don't have anything else to do. Now, the problem is that it's limited to simple data types. There are more sophisticated ways to create active values. For example, here I could add what's called a controller that maybe does some checking on the value, bound checking, or can do some transformation if I'm using different units or things like this. There are some active variables that work for things like lists displayed in the list widget, but it's a little bit essentially limited to simple data types. Also, the notion that when this value changes, the widget changes, depending on your programming language, can be difficult to implement. So there are toolkits that implement active values. One of my favorite ones is called Tickle TK. And it's very pleasant to program with this because it simplifies the code a lot. The last approach is the one that's used in things like Java. And, well, it's not exactly what's... Java does something close to this, but it's called message passing. So again, the idea, and it's always the same idea, is to create a link between a widget and an object in my program. So with callbacks, the link was with a function. With active variables, the link was with a variable. And with message, the link is with an object. And then this object must have a number of methods so that when I interact with the object, it calls a particular method. So here, I link my button to an object called save dialog, and then when I click OK, it will invoke the method clicked on the save dialog and giving it the event that we used for clicking. Now, if I get back to my example of the save dialog box, here's how I can get rid of the global variable by creating an object, the save dialog, that has a field, which is the file name. So it's pretty much the same as we saw before, but instead of using a global variable, now I have an object. I'm not calling just a function in the middle of nowhere. I'm calling a method of an object. And so this object provides a context for which I can have here the file name. So this is a clean version of what we have in the first example. And when you program with listeners in Java Swing, as you probably have done, this is essentially the model you have. It's a little bit different, but it's the same concept. So there are many toolkits. Here is a small list. The problem with toolkits is they encourage you, of course, to use the widgets that they have in their interface. And so the interaction is really limited to the widgets they have. And if you want to create a new type of widget, it's a lot of work. So that is one problem that I think explains why a lot of applications today use a lot of big dialog boxes with a lot of fields and a lot of complicated things for the user. It's because it was easy to build, easy to program, because you have, you know, all these fields and buttons already programmed for you. If the programmer was to make a specific input technique, like we saw in the classes last time, then it's a lot more work. The other thing is, widgets don't cover all the basic interactions you want. Drag and drop, for example, it's not a widget. A widget, really the idea is that it's an object that is on the screen and it manages interaction inside that object. Drag and drop is not a widget. And all these toolkits support drag and drop, but as a separate thing. It's not really integrated with the widgets, or very poorly. And finally, it is cumbersome to program. If you program a swing and you have to write, you know, hundreds of lines to create the widgets, to set all the parameters to the widgets, the layout objects, the set all the constraints in the layout, then set all the listeners. It's pages and pages and pages of code with hidden dependencies. And that makes the code very difficult to maintain. And it's also another reason why applications are sometimes not very reliable and don't change very much, is because it's, you know, for applications, 80% of the code, up to 80%, and certainly at least 50% of the code is just for the interface. Okay, now we get to frameworks and then a short demo. So the idea of a framework came with observing the fact that most applications look the same. Is that even if you have a toolkit, there's a lot of code in your application that looks the same. Especially if you have a file menu, so the notion that you are opening documents and that you can save the document and things like this. If you have cut, copy, and paste, if you have history, undo, redo, and things like this. And so, because it's so similar, the idea was to create an application skeleton, sort of template for an application where the code was incomplete, but it would tell you, add this here, add that there. And then this skeleton was enriched by a library of functions that didn't fit well with the toolkit. Things like history, copy-paste, drag-and-drop, these interactions that were not widget-oriented were managed at the skeleton level, or rather in the library that goes with the skeleton. And so the first application framework that was really widely used was MacApp, and it really allowed you to create an application with a lot of basic functionality very quickly. It had the concept of a document, the notion that a document is displayed in a window, but is also linked to a file. So things like keeping track of the history of command in that document, or when it had been saved, or things like copying and pasting various contents. All of this was sort of provided almost for free. And so the problem with the skeleton is that it gives you a framework for a standard application. And so sometimes you want to do something. If you're programming a game, for example, oftentimes the skeleton is not really going to help. So the skeleton is also another way to look at it, is that it's a solution to the problem that the tools and the programming languages that we use are not really adapted to programming and interaction. And so it's doing a number of things that probably should be done at a lower level in the system, but we don't have the right programming languages for that. And so that led in turn to the last tool in the big stack of layers, the interface builders. And here the idea was, well, if I can create an application with which I can draw you know, various diagrams and things like this, why cannot I draw the user interface itself? So the idea is that you have an editor where instead of, you know, basic shapes, you have the widgets and your toolkit. So with the editor, you create a description of your interface, and then you create the rest of your application, a separate module, and then you have the runtime of the interface builder. And so putting all this together, you create an application that will load the description of the interface, display it, and then with the callbacks, we'll invoke your code from the functional core, and we'll use some functions here from the library. Now, this means that when you run your application, you need to have this interface description separate, and you need to have this module that knows how to load this. So this is useful when you are developing your application, because it means a quick edit cycle. You can make changes to the interface without, as long as you don't change your functional core here, you don't have to rebuild your application. It just loads the new interface. Now, in production code, what you probably want to do is this interface description, compile it into code that gets itself compiled into the application. So this application now does not need the interface description. It's been compiled in. So you have these two modes in interface builders, the mode where you want to test and try, and the mode where you want to generate the final thing. So one thing I'm going to do is to show you, this is an old version of the interface builder. So interface builder was created originally at Next, and then when Apple acquired Next, and when Steve Jobs came back to Apple, they brought in a lot of the technologies that had been developed at Next, and that includes interface builder. And for the record, interface builder was created by a French researcher who was hired at Next, and his name is Jean-Marie Hulot. And he created the whole interface builder that is still in use today. So here is a version of, where is it? Yeah, here. So what I'm going to do here is to create a web browser without writing a line of code. Screen recording so people who aren't here can. Okay, so here's Xcode. So I'm going to create a new Xcode project. And I want to create a simplest application is called a Cocoa application. It's asking me the product name. So what do you want to call it? Okay, my web browser. It's already ready to put it up on the App Store, but I'm not going to do this today. And it's not a document-based application, and I will not need unit tests. So it's asking me where to put it, so I'm going to put it in here. And so it's creating a project here with already a number of things in there. I have what's called the app delegate, which is an object representing the application. And it has an interface file called main menu that already has a menu with all the standard commands that you may expect from an application. So what I'm going to do is first I need to tell it I'm going to use the web widget widget to display a web page that comes with the framework here. So I go here and I say I want to add something, and it's called WebKit. And it should be here, webkit.framework. So I add the framework here. And now I'm coming back to the interface builder. In this new version here, the interface builder is built into the... It used to be a separate application, now it's built into the development environment. So if I look here, I have the main menu, which is the thing I'm looking at now, and there's also one main window for my application. So in this main window, I'm going to want to add... So what do I need to do? A web browser. I need something to visualize the web page. What else?
Buttons.
Back forward.
Links.
Well, the links are in the page.
The address.
Yeah. The where to enter the address. Okay. So I need to get this thing. So I have to bring the object library here. So the object library is here on the right. So I see a push button. That sounds good. I'm going to put it here. I'm going to need another button for the forward. And what else do I need? Here I have text field. That should be good for entering the text. This is a very small screen. So now you see that when I move the buttons, it helps me to align them with the proper spacing that is consistent with the guidelines. So I'm going to do this like this. Now this button, I want to change its name. It's going to be back. And this one is going to be forward. Now this is spaced properly. And I need the thing to display the web page. So I find the WebKit part of the object library, and there is one thing called the WebView. So I put the WebView here. I'm going to have it fill the whole thing. And I have an interface. So now I can run this and see what happens. What do you think would happen? It works. So I don't have network here, so this is not going to be helpful. What I had prepared was a window with a file, so I can... So I can do this, and nothing happens. Now, of course, it's not that magic, right? So I need to tell a little bit more. So here, if I look at the web view and I use the context sensitive buttons, the right click, I have a number of what's called outlets and a number of actions. These are the things that corresponds to the link with the application, to the application interface, to callbacks. So if I look through this, there's a bunch of things here, download, delegate, menu, next key value. I don't know what these are. But if I go down here, I see go back. So go back, this sounds like the thing that will make it go back. So if I drag here and I go to the back button, well, it seems to want to link it, so that sounds promising. I'm going to do the same thing for go forward. Now, the other thing is, I need to make a link to this text. It needs to know where the URL comes from. So if I continue here, I have make text larger and smaller, so it's good. I know I could add buttons for this. Print, reload, stop loading, take string URL from. Mm-hmm. So if I take this and I put it here, it seems to like the text field. And so now I'm done with this. And I'm going to try again, run this thing. I it's already running, so yes, I'm stopping it. Succeed. Here I am. Still don't have a network, so I'm going to try with my file here. I go here, I do this, and here's the thing. Now I noticed something is the layout is not really what I expected. It's not resizing as I want. But I can play with this. I can go to this. The tabs in this page are terrible because it's so small. And I can try the back button. The back seems to work. Forward this seems to work. So now all I need to do is to go fix the layout. So of course it looked right here, but I hadn't said anything about the sizing. So if you look at this thing on the right, it shows you this little animation to show what happens. And we see that the widget, which is the little red dot here, stays at the bottom left. Now, if I play with these, I can have other things happen. I can have it bottom right. I can have it, seems to get bigger. If I do this, it seems to use the whole space. Mm-hmm. So this seems to tell me that it should grow with the thing. Now, the other thing I would like to do is for this one, I would like to also enlarge with the window. So I'm going to do it like this, and here to be more respectful of the proper margins that they seem to. Okay, so I'm going to try this again. Succeeds. Let me bring that page. Here we go. I try to resize. And as you see, the text field gets bigger, and so does the page. And now I have a page where the tabs look. So here it is, web browser without a line of code. Now, of course, things get more complicated once you want to do real things, right? but this is just to give you an idea of the things you can do with an interface builder. All the layout and a lot of the wiring of objects together can be done directly through interface builder. If I were to add my own callbacks, I could, in fact, write them here. And there is a side-by-side view where I see both the code and the interface, and I can link things between the two directly. So it's a powerful tool. Okay, so I'm going to close this. I don't know what happened to my recording. That's it for, I guess, this lecture. So, in summary, we've seen a number of tools from lower to higher level. All these tools make development easier, and they also make it easier to comply with the style guides to make applications that are more homogeneous with the other ones on the same platform. The interaction is based on widgets, which is good for many things, but is also a limitation. It is difficult to create new widgets, and it can be difficult to program non-standard interactions. For example, when the iPhone and iPad came out, Apple had to create a new toolkit library for touch-based interaction, because the widgets, the mouse oriented widgets just didn't work. And if you had to do this yourself, it's a lot of work. So in terms of research issues, there is the issue of how do you go beyond the widget model? How do you make it so not everything has to be a widget? We have been so used to think in terms of this abstraction that it's hard to imagine how to get out of it. And another aspect is there is such a mismatch between the concepts you use to program an interface and the languages that you use to program the interface. In Java, the notion of anonymous inner classes was added to the language explicitly to program listeners. I don't know if you remember how you program listeners, but you can write the listeners in the middle of the code. You can say, you know, new listener, and then create your callback in there. This whole syntactic construct and the semantics that go with it were added to the language especially for user interface creation. Not only, it's used in other areas as well. And so I think having languages that are really designed for creating interactive systems is also an interesting area for research. And so with that, we'll take a break, and then I'll tell you a bit about instrumental interaction. You have any questions?